Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. As you just saw, they are back in Parliament. But what will they accomplish after a five-month hiatus? Parliament finally returns, but with only 20 days to work, what will they do? Will 10-day paid sick leave happen for federally regulated workplaces? What about reduced COVID supports? Will that get support? In moments, the House leaders will join us on the new lay of the land, plus the mystery of the vaccinated Conservative MPs. Check this out.
Statistically, the likelihood that they would have multiple people who are exempt on that basis is extraordinarily low. There might be some possibility of it, but I suppose there's a possibility that chair could fly.
Why won't the Conservatives say how many of their members have medical exemptions for the COVID vaccine, and why do the Liberals not trust them? We'll drill down on that after one Conservative MP tested positive for COVID recently. And potato politics, warts and all.
There is nothing wrong with our potatoes. They are of the highest quality. They are the best in the world, and they are sought after by our partners around the world for that very reason.
Why did Ottawa suddenly halt shipments of PEI potatoes to the U.S.? Are they concerned about warts on it? And why is PEI so furious about it? We're actually going to hear from Canada's agriculture minister on why she pulled the trigger on that. And then that man, the premier of PEI, is going to get in, join us on this hot political potato. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So as you saw at the top, Parliament is back. The first order of business, electing a new speaker, or in this case, re-electing one. This is what happened.
I invite Mr. Rota.
Yes, there he is, Anthony Rota, who became the speaker first in 2019, is escorted there by Justin Trudeau and Erin O'Toole down the aisle. You see him struggling there. This is his second term. He's symbolically supposed to struggle and fight the two leaders to take the chair. It's to show that he's reluctantly taking it. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, it was a dangerous job. Some speakers were actually killed. So that's where that tradition comes from. But of course, Anthony Rota absolutely loves the job. So he gets it for the second term. So now we get to the rest of the parliamentary business. And there's lots of it. After the speech from the throne, which will take place tomorrow, that's where the government lays out their agenda. The government's going to face a new reality. Time, not a lot of it. The House sits for only 4 weeks before they rise yet for another break, the six-week holiday break. This is what they want to get done before then. New pandemic aid programs, the reduced ones, protection of healthcare workers and facilities, 10-day paid sick leave for federally regulated workers, and they want to pass that conversion therapy ban. Can they do it all? Well, the NDP has been the government's reliable political dance partner for the last parliamentary session, but can they depend on the NDP this time? And while the Liberals are questioning how many Conservative members have vaccine mandate exemptions to get back in the House, why does it matter so much? Well, let's find out. All right, joining me now is the government House leader, Mark Holland. Good to have you on the program, and everyone's back. Let's start with some, there's lots on the agenda, but you have had concerns about the number of Conservatives who say that they have a medical exemption. Are you now satisfied that the House has checked everyone and all MPs who are in the House today are either vaccinated or have a legitimate medical exemption?
Well, Evan, we know last week the Conservatives had an individual who tested positive for COVID. We don't know whether or not these unvaccinated members, and we don't know how many of these members were there or weren't there. And we still don't know, as I say, that number of unvaccinated members. Our concern is that a medical exemption should be something in the range of about 1 in 100,000. And so for there be multiple people who are potentially in the Conservative caucus unvaccinated, it just doesn't add up in right. terms of math. So we need to know that these medical exemptions are legitimate. And, the chief medical officer of health and other medical officers of health have been very specific about what constitutes a legitimate vaccination.
But,
and this is a matter of public health.
Okay, but the Conservatives are saying you're casting doubt on the House of Commons is supposed to give them either the green light or not. So whether you know if someone's got a legit exemption or not, as I understand it, you correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand it, the Conservatives are saying we've submitted all our status to the Parliament, and they have decided that everyone either is double vaccinated or they have a legitimate medical exemption status. So are you questioning that Parliament has not done a thorough enough check of these medical exemptions?
No, what I'm saying is that right now we can't. The only thing that they can do is receive a letter saying that the person has a medical exemption. They can't know what the nature of that exemption is or whether or not it actually constitutes what the Chief Medical Officer of Health has said is a legitimate exemption. So they're just receiving a letter and they have no additional context.
What's your
to
worry?
It, which is
like,
why
I'm just trying. Are you worried that someone's got a doctor to give them a medical exemption for something that's not legit?
We know that there are about 1 in 100,000 people who should have a legitimate medical exemption. That means in a caucus of 119, if you have multiple people, there's a better chance of, you know, the chair I'm sitting on turning into a tiger than that being the case, that you would have that many exemptions in a pool of such a small number of people. So the problem
you think
is...
I just want to just be clear. So you're saying...
No.
Your concern is bogus medical exemptions. Is that it?
My concern is that whatever exemption that they've been given is not actually a legitimate exemption as per the Chief Medical Officer of Health's definition of what should constitute an exemption. And I think that when we're talking about a workplace, you know, we're talking about the House of Commons and the precinct as a workplace that staff work in, journalists work in, House administration work in, that MPs work in, that folks have to know that workplace right. is safe. And right now, the numbers don't add up. They don't make sense. And, you know, it's particularly unusual to me that the Conservatives won't even tell us how many folks aren't exempt, aren't vaccinated, that we don't even know what that number is. So, you know, it's very difficult to look at people in the eyes and tell them this is a safe place to work on the one hand. And on the other, the math just not add up.
Oh, okay. Let me move on from vaccine mandates. That's one big issue. There's about what? 2 weeks before the Parliament rises again for the break, you got an ambitious agenda. How are you going to pass the big four, let's call them? The new pandemic age, the NDP don't like it. They say don't reduce the aid. The Conservatives like it. You got protections for healthcare workers. You've got conversion therapy issue. There's a bunch of key issues. How do you get it all done in the next 14 days?
Well, it starts a lot earlier than today. Obviously, we've been having conversations with my counterparts. I've been having conversations with my counterparts in other parties. Prime ministers have talked with all the leaders of the other parties. We've been constantly working and trying to find common ground on all of these issues. And so there's been a lot of positive movement, positive conversations around how we can collaborate on these issues. And that gives me hope. In fact, I would go so far as to say that I'm cautiously optimistic that we can work together and get this done. I think if everybody acts in good faith, then we should be able to get this done. And I think that's what Canadians expect. You know, you look at what we're talking about here, making sure that we continue to have the backs of people who need help in this pandemic and don't have the support they need, protecting health sites, having paid sick leave, making sure that we ban conversion therapy. It's aggressive, but I have every reason to believe, based on the cooperation and the conversations that we've had to date, that it's doable.
Okay, yeah, and it's about 20 days, so you got another 5 days, I think, that I said.
Right.
Let me talk about the reduced COVID supports, because the normal dance partner for your party is the NDP. They do not like this. Mr. Singh has already said he doesn't want that. Can you count on the NDP for support on that particular issue? And just as a corollary to that, there's been a lot of reporting that your party behind the scenes is working on some kind of informal deal with the NDP on certain things. Is that happening? Are there backroom deals going on between the Liberals and the NDP to keep Parliament going, maybe longer than the average span of a minority government, about 18 months, 2 years?
Look, I am entirely focused on the session that's in front of us and getting the bills that I have outlined adopted. And that is working with every party. So there's conversations happening with every party around how we can work together, how we can find common ground. I mean, I look at the COVID bill specifically. The reality is there are still individuals who are being hard hit and need support. But we also know that the economy is doing very well right now. We're doing better than most G7 countries. In fact, our job situation is better now than it was before the pandemic. So it makes sense there should be an evolution to these benefits. And so these are the conversations that we're having.
Right.
And I think this is what you're going to see in this parliament generally, is that we're prepared to work with reasonable people on reasonable things.
But okay, just real quick. But is there a specific negotiation negotiation going on with the NDP?
I have had no conversations about anything other than how we can work together in this parliament with all parties on the issues and priorities that Canadians have.
Inflation is at an 18-year high. Are the Liberals open to changing the promise of stimulus because of the concern about inflation?
Well, we know that there are disruptions in the supply chain, and that's creating issues around the world with the disruptions that are causing higher prices. And obviously, you know, that's a conversation to have with Chrystia as well. But I think I can say on behalf of the government that we are monitoring all of this in a real-time basis to make sure the supports that Canadians need are there and that we are not leaving people behind and being affected by this pandemic in a way that, you know, frankly, wouldn't allow them to pay their bills.
Will there be an emergency debate on the crisis in BC? I know the NDP and the Conservatives want it.
Yeah, we're entirely open to having an emergency debate on this issue. So I have no objection to that whatsoever. Obviously, it's a very challenging, concerning situation that's unfolding in British Columbia. I think all parliamentarians of every political background want to see us do everything that we possibly can. I welcome that input.
All right, I got to leave it there. Okay, welcome back. We'll find out. New speaker, speech from the throne tomorrow. And Mark Collin will be a busy man as the House leader. Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Okay, here's some other busy people. That's the government's House leader. What about the opposition House leaders? Are the Conservatives and the NDP willing to play ball with the Liberals? Let's find out. Conservative Party Deputy House Leader Michael Barrett joins us, and the NDP House Leader Peter Julian does. Gents, good to have both of you back. Mr. Barrett, I'll start with you. Mark Collin hitting hard at the Conservatives, saying he doesn't trust that they have medical exemptions, that it's statistically improbable that multiple MPs in your party need a medical exemption for COVID-19. What's the response?
Look, from the very beginning, we were clear in response to the Board of Internal Economy's directive with respect to return to work. And that was that we would follow the guidelines that were set out. And so we asked our caucus if they would be able to provide the documentation that was requested from the House. And the answer was yes. And so we've done exactly that. And from the beginning, we have deferred and trusted medical experts. And so if in consultation with one's physician, they've said, yep, get vaccinated, like I've done, got doubly vaccinated, that's great. And they've demonstrated proof of that. Right. If there is a contraindication or a health risk to an individual, then they've received an exemption from their doctor and they've provided documentation for that. So we're very focused. You know, the Liberals, Mr. Holland, thought that this would be some kind of great barrier for Conservatives to overcome. He fails to recall that last year it was us that was pushing them to provide vaccines for Canadians. Now those vaccines are available. We're encouraging people to get vaccinated, and we're ready to get to work. So we want to talk about the issues that Canadians are seized with.
Lord knows I do too. So can you just tell us then, how many of your MPs are double vaxxed? Just what's the number? We can lay this whole bloody thing to rest. Mr. Barrett, how many Conservative MPs showed up today with medical exemptions? 1, 2, 5, 8? Tell us the number. We can lay this darn thing to rest.
Evan, what we asked our caucus to do was to comply with the order from the Board of Internal Economy. And we did not.
But just how many? So just tell us how many had a medical exemption.
You'd have to
ask. But you don't know? You don't know how many got vaxxed?
We just asked them to comply with the directive from the Board of Internal Economy. And so that question could be answered by House Administration, who we have every confidence did their due diligence.
Okay. The only reason I'm pressing is you and I went out for a drink tonight, we went to a restaurant, they'd ask us to see if we're double vaxxed, we'd have to show. Didn't your party just say, okay, there's 119 people in this room, how many are double vaxxed? Show us. How many have a medical exemption? Then everyone will know. Did you not do that?
We all provided each of us, each parliamentarian and their staff had to provide the appropriate credentials to the House of Commons. So it was different than a show of hands in a room. And we all went through that process. And so if we go out, you'll see that I'm vaccinated. I have my COVID code like most. Right. So, that, you know, I can't speak for what the intent of their policy was. They wanted to make sure it was a safe workplace, created the framework, and we're operating exactly inside that framework.
Okay. Peter Julian, what's your take on all this?
Well, the Board of Internal Economy made the decision that everyone had to be double vaxxed. That made sense, of course. We're protecting employees. We're also protecting the public because the members of parliament are traveling across the country. Some of us come from high COVID infection rate zones, others from low infection rate zones. The possibility of COVID being transferred and brought back to those low transmission zones is something we have to be very aware of. But the Board of Internal Economy also coupled a medical exemption with regular testing every couple of days. And so what the board needs to do, of course, is sit down, look at what has happened over the last few days and whether that test order is being complied with. That's something that the board does with every health and safety regulation that it puts into place.
Okay. Do you have any concerns? Just I'm trying to lay this thing to rest because we've got actually the business of Parliament to get to. But Mr. Julian, do you have any concerns like the Liberals about if anybody's got a medical exemption that's, I guess, not appropriate?
Well, the rate is very high, given that the Government of Ontario indicates that medical contraindications is 1 in 100,000 people. So I think it would be a good question of transparency for the Conservatives to come clean on that. And I think part of the fact that of some concern is the fact that they just haven't released the numbers. But ultimately, the Board of Internal Economy will have the numbers, will have whether the test results are being respected. And I think that will help to clarify things in the next few days.
Okay, Mr. Barrett, will the Conservatives vote for the reduced wage and rent supports and ending the Canada Recovery Benefit Program? That's going to be top of the agenda. I know your party's called for that. Will you support that?
You know, one of the challenges that we've had leading up to the return of Parliament, I know we just heard that Mr. Holland said that there's been, you know, extensive consultations that have been happening. That's really, not the case. And so there's been a real lack of information provided from the government with respect to the details of what they're going to be presenting. And so when we see legislation in its final form, we're going to be able to comment definitively on whether or not we'll support it. But we have said very clearly that the government needs to get they need to get the inflation crisis under control. And part of the problem is that they're spending without target and without plan. And, you know, the announcement with respect to some of these pandemic relief measures that they made was on the eve of the expiry of those programs. And so it's really a scattershot approach where they're not planning, they're not consulting, they're not weighing what the outcomes are going to be or the potential outcomes are going to be from their decisions. So they need to do that. They need to consult. They need to work with parliamentarians and not just expect to show up and that the big rubber stamp is going to hit the page. And that's why we're so eager to get back to work.
Well, they've got 20 days, Mr. Julian. The Conservatives want the reduced wage and rent supports. They want to end that Canada Recovery Benefit. The Liberals want it. Your party's been their supporter, but you don't want that. So what will your party do when that comes on the table in the next coming days?
Well, we said, and Jagmeet Singh was crystal clear, when they eliminated the emergency benefits for 800,000 Canadians with only a few days' notice, that was unacceptable. And you couple that, of course, with all of the other problems that Canadians are experiencing. Seniors are being clawed back on their guaranteed income supplement because the Liberals didn't put in place appropriate regulations to ensure that that emergency benefit could go without this clawback. So you're seeing now seniors going far below the poverty line, struggling to put food on the table, keep a roof over their head. And this is deliberate, an action that the Liberals took that they have deliberately so far chosen not to fix. Same with the Canadian Child Tax Benefit. Same with the low-income clawback that we're seeing for CERB benefits. So there are a number of issues that really impact Canadians that are struggling at this critical time in the midst of a fourth wave. And the NDP will be their advocates, will strongly speak out on their behalf now that the House has finally resumed.
Well, we'll find out who supports who. There's lots to be done in the next 20-odd days. Mr. Barrett, Mr. Julian, it is good to see everyone back at it here in Ottawa. Thanks, gents.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Okay, we look forward to having more chats on that. But very tragic and sad news from the Senate this weekend, where Senator Josie Forrest-Niessing died after a month-long battle with COVID-19. She was only 56 years old. The Ontario senator had recently returned home from hospital. She was fully vaccinated, but she was considered to be at high risk because she had an autoimmune condition affecting her lungs. She was appointed by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in 2018. Before that, she spent 2 decades as a lawyer, where she was a staunch supporter of the access to the legal system in both official languages. Rest in peace. Our condolences go out to her family. And while parliamentarians made their return to the House of Commons today, British Columbia is bracing for the return of another atmospheric river. Here we go again. Danger far from past. Up to 100 millimeters of rain might be in the cards for the north coast, along with strong southerly winds. The meteorologists are warning that landslides and widespread flooding are possible again. And while the heavy rain is falling in the northern part of the province, it's still causing concern in the areas already flooded by the previous atmospheric river. This weather system is expected to turn south and bring additional rain to areas already underwater. And the BC Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure is reporting another highway has been washed out. BC Highway 3 now closed in both directions between the cities of Hope and Princeton, a sign of how precarious the situation still is. Let's get an update on the ground in British Columbia from the commander, the military commander, overseeing the military's deployment to the province. There are already 500 members of Canada's military. There, Rear Admiral Angus Topshe is the commander of the Joint Task Force Pacific and the Maritime Forces Pacific, and joins us now. Rear Admiral Topshe, first of all, thank you for your service to the country and for the men and women who serve, and thanks for joining us. Can you be very specific what the military are doing right now in British Columbia?
Certainly. So we've got both an air task force deployed into the region with a number of different fixed and rotary wing helicopters available, scalable series of assets. So some smaller helicopters and some medium lift helicopters, as well as a number of fixed wing aircraft that can be used to move supplies and personnel rapidly about the province as required by Emergency Management British Columbia. In addition, we've got a land force component that is nearly 400 people in 4 different maneuver elements that are available to do tasks such as sandbagging, assisting farmers with the movement of animals from barns without heat to barns with heat. And they are right now working with the province to define the best tasks for them to take on as we look to continue to assist BC in its recovery.
So about 400, and we've heard there's available up to 500. So I guess there's a sense that could that force grow, and especially if there's another atmospheric river coming.
So we're monitoring the weather forecast very closely. And as you noted, so it is potentially up to 100 millimeters of rain, but that is farther to the north in the province in a different part. So we're not anticipating that that's going to impact our efforts around Chilliwack and in the interior and the central regions of British Columbia. But we are obviously going to monitor that very carefully. And if we see that we need additional forces, we will. As for the number, right now, we're satisfied that the forces that are in the province are sufficient to meet the needs that the government of British Columbia has expressed to us. And we're continuing to work with the province to make sure that we've completed a reconnaissance of all of the roads and identified those areas where they need our assistance to return services to the citizens of British Columbia.
And finally, I mean, there's search and rescue, there's rebuild, there's so much going on here. How long could the men and women of the military be there for?
So our task is usually in the initial, response phase of the operation. So as you saw on the very first day of the operation, it was search and rescue helicopters that evacuated nearly 300 people from who had been isolated on a highway by landslides. We provided that immediate response capability. Now the province is assessing their longer term needs. We're not the people who are going to ultimately repair the major highway spans of British Columbia, but we are going to go out there and take care of those immediate response tasks. Right now, the mission is scheduled to be over around the 17th of December, but it really comes down to an evaluation each day to make sure that we're continuing to contribute something necessary to assist the province in recovering from this event.
Rear Admiral Angus Topshe, first of all, thank you, and thank all the men and women for their extraordinary service, always helping out Canadians in a time of need. We really salute you and the men and women who put themselves in harm's way to do so. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Meantime, farmers in BC are facing a crisis, as you just saw those pictures, from the devastating floods that are submerging the farmland, killing livestock, and cutting off critical supply chains. And out east in Prince Edward Island, farmers are facing a different challenge, a sudden and shocking export ban on their island's key export, potatoes. So while Mother Nature is causing disruptions in BC, in PEI, the government is pointing the finger at the federal government, the provincial government, for causing the trade disruption there over, well, the potato wart. It's a soil-borne fungus that can remain dormant in the field for more than 40 years. Although potato warts are ugly, they pose no threat to human health or food safety. But the potato wart is considered a quarantine pest because of its impact on farm yields and marketability. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency confirmed the presence of the potato wart in two PEI fields. So as Canada suspends potato trade between PEI and the U.S., did the federal government kneecap the island's key export? Well, the Agriculture Minister, Marie-Claude Bibeau, was in part of that, and she joins us now. Great to have you here. Before we get to the potato issue, let me just go to BC. Farmers there are absolutely getting crushed. As you know, it's a critical area. What is the federal government doing specifically to help farmers and who have lost livestock and potentially fields and lots of crops?
Well, as you know, we have our incident working group, response group. So numerous ministers, federal ministers are working together to try to support the province the best we can. I am in regular contact with the Minister of Agriculture, Minister Popham as well. And we are doing it in different ways. So over and above the emergency response, as you've just talked about with the Admiral, we are trying to support our farmers to save their animals, feed their animals, also support the food supply chain, either through facilitating or giving more flexibility to the regulation with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, also with the border and through the collaboration with the United States as well. So making sure that we make the food supply chain function the best in the circumstances.
Do you have any idea of how many livestock have been lost?
Not yet. It's too soon. Many farmers haven't had the opportunity to go back to their farm yet. But we're talking about hundreds of thousands of birds, for example.
Okay, Minister, let me go from the West Coast to the East Coast. The Premier of PEI is standing by to talk to us. He's livid at you because he said that you preemptively put a ban on fresh potato exports to the U.S. because of the wart. And he said none of those potatoes were going to go to the U.S. anyway. They had it under control and you've undermined their key export. Why did you ban that and what's your response to that?
Well, two decisions have been taken. One through a ministerial order, the other one through a suspension of the export to the U.S. And if we have not done that, we would be facing an American ministerial order by now, suspending potato seeds, potatoes and potatoes to be processed in the U.S. So first, with the new findings of potato wart on the island, we have to be extremely careful with potato seeds because these potatoes are destined to be put in the soil. So there's a higher level of risk, and this is why potato seeds are limited, to stay on the island. And other potatoes can travel across Canada and in other countries further to phytosanitary measures. So we are safe that they would not present. And I'm very confident that we can export our table potato and potatoes to be processed outside right. of the island. And this is our decision. But it's not good enough for the Americans. And they said either we suspend for a while, for the time that we pursue the discussion, and we make the demonstration that the table potatoes and potatoes to be processed in the U.S. do not pose any risk, which I think it's the case. But we have to work with our partner. We have to make further analysis and demonstration that it's safe.
But how long? I got the premier coming on. A, how long will this ban last for? And is the federal government going to give assistance to PEI farmers?
I've spoken to the secretary, the agriculture secretary, Vilsack, three times this week. I see that he is talking about a temporary ban. And he's open for scientific-based discussions, and we will put all our resources to resume the trade with the U.S. as soon as possible. In terms of support to the farmers, we have the business risk management programs to start with. Most of the potato farmers on the island have already registered to AgriStability. I will be working with Minister Thompson on an agri-recovery-based program, for example. So, yes, there are programs in place to support farmers.
All right. Agriculture Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau, I really appreciate, Minister, you joining us. You got business on the East Coast and on the West Coast. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So the federal government's view on the PEI potato ban is they had to do it to preempt the U.S. from doing it, but the PEI farmers and the premier does not like it. This is a $1.3 billion industry. So what's the response from Prince Edward Island? Well, their premier, Dennis King, joins us now. Premier King, good to have you on the program. You just heard the minister say, we had to do this to preempt the U.S. from doing it. So this was actually the prudent thing to do. What's your response?
Well, I also heard the minister just say that they're going to use science to make their decisions, when in fact, we've just gone through a process today where science has absolutely nothing to do with the decision. So I'm perplexed and confused even further based on the minister's comments. I have no doubt the United States are a difficult trading partner, but also we're a very big trading partner as well, and we can stand up and fight for what's right, fight for science, and that's what we should do. The minister seems to suggest they're going to do that now. Why we need to close down the border to protect the science that we know that works, that CFIA has developed and the USDA has accepted. I can't understand where the minister's coming from in this regard. No.
Okay, so she says, look, once you get potato warts, there's a concern that it will impact yields. You know the politics and the impact of these things. That if you ship these to the U.S., things could get a lot worse. Were these potatoes going to the U.S.? Were there protocols in place to deal with this in a way that did not require this kind of ban?
We've been dealing with potato wart in Prince Edward Island for 21 years, Evan. Not once in the 23 countries that we export potatoes to has there ever been potato wart connected to a find in Prince Edward Island. We have protocols that are in place, a potato wart management plan that is in place that was developed with the CFIA, that is the accepted scientific protocol by the USDA, and that's exactly what it's for. In this particular case, there were two cases of wart found in two separate fields for processing potatoes that were already being regulated by CFIA. So by design, these potatoes were going to be processed in Prince Edward Island, never to leave Prince Edward Island. The program we have in place works. It is above and beyond what anybody else in the world does, and it should stand the test right now. And why it isn't, we can't understand.
Okay. Premier, lay this to rest for me then. What we understand is that the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the CFIA, says that the U.S. notified Canada in October that they will impose a federal order banning all imports of fresh potatoes from your island for an undetermined amount of time unless Canada voluntarily takes immediate action, so the federal government did. Is that true?
Well, we haven't seen any documentation to back that up. When we asked the minister on the call last night what exactly is the conversation, all we hear is if we don't, they might. I suspect that's because this is a trade issue and not a scientific issue. Science is on our side. The minister should stand up and say, you can't take this action because this is the accepted science that allows potatoes to flow both ways across the border. As I say, it doesn't add up to me. I don't know what's at play here, what other factors are in play. We can't quite figure out. This is the government of Canada who did this. This isn't the United States. The government of Canada did this to island potato farmers and potentially devastate our most important economic industry.
Okay, let's talk about that. What will the impact be economically?
Well, this is $1.3 billion on an annual basis. I think with the crop that we had this year, the health of it, and the size of it, it probably would have been closer to $1.5 billion. So in PEI terms, this is like the auto industry in Ontario, the forestry industry in British Columbia, oil and gas in Alberta. Pick one, what you want. $1.5 billion industry, 80% of our business is the United States, and we're just been shut out of it. So what do you think the impact is?
So, it's going to be devastating. So, and I know the minister just said that all these farmers are applying for support. What happens to all these potatoes now?
Well, here's the dilemma. We have perfect high-quality potatoes. We have a reputation around the world for having the highest quality. We have these potatoes. Other regions across North America haven't had the successful season that we've had weather-wise for a variety of issues. The market needs our potatoes. The market wants our potatoes, and they're the healthiest potatoes, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with these potatoes. So if they're not able to be shipped in a timely manner, they will have to be destroyed, and that would be a travesty. That would be a terrible shame in a world that needs food, where supply chains are being impacted, etc. Why we would allow this to happen is beyond me. It's beyond comprehension for us here in PEI.
Okay, just in 10 seconds, so what are you going to do to fight back? Like, what's the next move here? The ban's in place.
Well, I mean, we've got to keep talking to our partners. We've got to do maybe a little bit of a lobby in the U.S. so they can understand. And I think you're going to hear some lobby from the U.S. because partners down there need our potatoes and they want our potatoes. So we just have to keep hammering away here.
All right, Premier of Prince Edward Island, Premier King, really devastating news for farmers there. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time, and I know there's a big fight coming up ahead on that. All right, so you heard from the federal government, you heard from PEI on that. Stay with us. The minority parliament is back in session. Lots on the table already. Will it be business as usual? The Liberals found a reliable dance partner with the NDP last time. Can they rely on them again? The press gallery digs into what to expect in the 44th session of Parliament next.
Bonjour, good day.
Welcome back. The 44th Parliament is in session today. You might be getting a sense of deja vu. The Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, holds a minority government. The Speaker of the House is Anthony Rota, the Liberal MP. He was just re-elected. The Green MP, Elizabeth May, is deriding partisanship in the House. The Conservatives are already fighting with the Liberals over vaccines. And no one's sure if the NDP will support the Liberals or not. So will this new Parliament be same old, same old? Let's find out. The press gallery is here. Joyce Napier, the CTV National News Ottawa Bureau Chief, is here. And Ian Bailey, reporter with the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau, who writes the Daily Politics Briefing. Good to see you both here. Joyce, okay. There's two issues. There's the vaccine mandate kerfuffle, and there's the substance of what gets done. Liberal House Leader Mark Holland was on this program and earlier saying, look, we've got an ambitious agenda, yeah, but by the way, I don't trust the Conservatives who got these exemptions from the vaccines. Is this story still going on? Like, where is this going with these vaccine mandate stories and the Conservatives?
Well, it's still going on for two reasons. First reasons is the Liberals love it, and they'll keep it going as long as they can. This is politics, and sometimes it can get nasty. And also because the Conservatives are actually allowing the Liberals to play with this. It's not that complicated. Are you vaccinated? It's yes or no. Do you have an exemption? Yes, if you have an exemption. But look, the statistics are clear. In Canada, in the population, it's 1 in 100,000 medical exemptions. If the Conservatives come back and have 4 exemptions for 119 MPs, then yes, you've got to ask yourself a question or two. But look, the Conservatives can make this go away by just answering the questions and telling, you know, the people of Canada and their constituents who is vaccinated, who isn't, and who has an exemption, and then we can, move on.
Yeah, Ian, it's hard to hold the Liberals' feet to the fire when you're tripping on your own vaccine feet here. And I just asked the Deputy House Leader for the Conservatives, Michael Barrett, look, I'm happy to let this to rest. How many of your MPs are doubly vaxxed and how many have a medical exemption? And he says, we never ask. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, this is going to be there are still questions about this issue, and we will ask further questions until we get our answers. Questions were being raised today of the Conservatives, and we didn't get all the answers, and I'm sure, you know, questions will continue to be raised on this subject going forward until it's resolved. And it doesn't look at this point like the Conservatives are necessarily going to open up and sort of provide all of the information to answer all of our questions. But so it goes on, and it will go on. It just, seems as simple as that.
Yeah, political. I guess if you hand someone a needle, they'll keep jabbing you with it, Joyce. Joyce, what about the 20 sitting days scheduled before another break? What are the biggest challenges facing a government that wants to pass four key pieces of legislation? They want to, they've got the 10 days paid sick leave for federally regulated workers. They've got the reduced COVID supports. They've got the conversion therapy bill. They got some legislation that they got to pass, Joyce.
And also they want to ban protests in front of hospitals and clinic so that healthcare workers can get into work. Well, listen, 4 weeks. They've got 4 weeks to do all that. This is a house that sat 96 days by December 17th. It will be 96 days of work in the house. And for the first time since the pandemic, most of them were there in person today. So they have 4 weeks to pass these four bills. I wish them luck. Will they have the support of the Conservatives on some of these provisions, perhaps? Look, you've got Jagmeet Singh already saying, we'll support some of it. We'll see. We're going to look at this. So not automatic support from the NDP. But then again, keep in mind one thing. None of these parties want to go into an election anytime soon. They're going to have to play ball with each other. That's what I'm going to be looking at, how they have to, make nice in order for them to get through these next 4 weeks. And, beyond the next 4 weeks and not call an election, at least for the next 2 years.
Well, yeah, although anything could happen in a minority government, and we've seen that before. Ian, what are you looking for in terms of the bills that have to get passed now that, we're actually getting down to some business? So what's going to happen in the next month?
Well, I'll be interested to see if income support, the Canada Recovery Benefit, how that works out with the NDP, because Mr. Singh made it clear today that he had some very considerable concerns about that. So it'll be interesting to see the common ground there. I got to say it's going to be interesting and important to see if the House can agree on measures to help British Columbia. It's been striking to see unanimity between the Conservatives and the Liberals on this issue. You see images from British Columbia of broken roads, highways smashed. That stuff needs to be repaired. And so it's going to be striking to see if they can come together to expedite whatever Parliament can do to sort of help with that issue. Those issues in particular are striking me.
Yeah, and George, there may actually be an emergency debate. I know they're calling for that on British Columbia. There's some other interesting things that before the House broke for the summer, George, the government priorities, firearms, the bill to modernize the Broadcasting Act, the controversial Bill C-10, are those a priority?
Well, if you talk to the Liberals, everything is a priority, really. But in 4 weeks, you really have to prioritize your priorities. And that's what they did. They gave you those four priorities that the House leader gave you. And those are the clear ones for the next 4 weeks. But it's hard to see this happen in 4 weeks. I guess that's what we all will be looking at is can they work this fast in a minority government when, each party is going to try to pull the blanket right towards them. So I'm curious to see how well they will work together. And I don't think they have a choice. So they will have to work together. That's what we'll look at. And, I think there will be an emergency debate for British Columbia. And there you could see them coming together. I think that will actually, you can see probably even unanimity in the House on that particular debate.
Yeah. And Ian, just in the last couple seconds I've got, remember, before the election, Justin Trudeau says we need an election because it's too toxic. Well, he's back to square one. You were up on the Hill today. How toxic was it?
Well, it was striking to see so many people in one chamber like that. It's the routine of business on Parliament, but in this pandemic age, to see the full House largely there, though masked, was quite a striking sight. And today, obviously, was a day for electing the Speaker, so perhaps not as toxic as, say, the first question period, which should be coming up pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's like in BC. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. And if you don't like the mood in Parliament, wait 5 minutes. It'll change, and it'll change tomorrow for the speech on the throne. Joyce Napier and Ian Bailey, great to have the two of you here. As the 44th session of Parliament kicks off, that is your Power Play Day in politics. Now, we will be back at 12 p.m. Eastern for our special coverage. Joyce will be part of that. We've got a great CTV team, and I'll be anchoring this great coverage that we will have of the speech from the throne. What's at stake? You'll see it all and how it matters to you tomorrow, 12 p.m. Eastern. So check that out on CTV News Channel. Hug your loved ones. It's always a great privilege. And we'll see you tomorrow. Have a great evening.